This is Solo Travel Talk, the Japan series. Your solo travel advisor and host is Astrid Clements.
It's more than sushi, that's for sure. And on this episode of Solo Travel Talk, your solo travel advisor, Astrid Clements, is not only going to share the good eats and sips she enjoyed while in Japan, but also share what she learned about the country and culture as well. I'm producer Catherine O'Brien. From miso to bento, from tea to sake, from rice to fish, Astrid will tell all. You might not want to listen to this episode in Astrid's Japan series if you are hungry.
I'll start by saying the Japanese are so passionate about food. Similar to the French, which I didn't realize they were that food-oriented like the French, but they are exactly. You should just basically think this is the Asian version of the French philosophy about food and eating. The Japanese believe that the meal should be beautiful in presentation as well as stimulating to the palate. To eat is to celebrate life. That's really it in just a couple of little sentences. But now I'm going to go into really what Japanese food culture is all about. And I think you're going to find this very interesting because I learned a lot of this when I was in Japan, but also in preparation for the show, I learned a little bit more. And I thought, oh, well, that's why they did that and this kind of thing. Let's start. Every meal in Japan should consist of something from the earth and something from the sea. That is their fundamental construction of a meal or how they approach what they want to eat. Sushi is the epitome of this concept. But they'll substitute noodles for the rice. But the rice really has been the staple food for over 2,000 years in Japan. It built the Japanese empire. It was the first real good that they had to trade among themselves and others. Rice is fundamental. It's from the land, and there were agrarian society, and they, like you'll find out, they have rice at every meal, or they substitute the noodles. But you will get a bowl of sticky rice, or if you don't get sticky rice, you'll have rice cakes or rice crackers. They might even prepare rice balls if it's a little fancier, that are stuffed with vegetables or fish, and they'll wrap it in seaweed. But the bottom line is sticky rice with every meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So that's a fundamental element of a Japanese meal. The second is miso soup. Now, not a lot of Westerners know totally about miso soup, but it's usually part also of every meal, even breakfast. Soup for breakfast. That's kind of hard for most Americans, really, to think that they would be in the mood for soup at breakfast. But it's basically a broad broth soup that has a seafood or a kelp base. They also put tofu in it, and they'll flavor it with other things. But the miso soup, it's really with almost every meal. If you don't get it at every meal, there's a reason. This is only going to give you skewered chicken on a stick, but that's like a street food. It's not really a meal. So you'll have the rice, the miso soup, and then the main portion, which is really rounded out with some kind of meat or seafood. Now, one other element to the basic Japanese meal is pickled vegetables. They have pickled vegetables at every meal, to include breakfast. Now, I kept thinking when I was getting these vegetables at breakfast, I thought, this just seems so odd. There are several reasons why they serve these pickled vegetables. It just seems like it's out of whack, but it's not. Traditional Japanese cooking is called washoku, and it's based on the rules of five. underneath that, these rules help the meal to have variety and balance. This is very important to have interest to it and balance in all elements. So you have, first of all, the five colors, white, black, red, yellow, green. They like variety of color in these five colors. Five cooking techniques, whether it's raw food, grilling, boiling, steaming, or frying. Then you have the five flavors, sweet, sour, salty, spicy, and bitter. Japanese cooks or chefs, they really do try to put as many of these fives in every meal they do. Even if it's simple, they try to do that. They also seek to get the freshest ingredients and, as I said at the beginning, a beautiful presentation. All of this is so key to the fundamentals of traditional Japanese cooking. So think the fives, the fresh ingredients, and the beautiful presentation of it. Now, until I went to Japan, I never realized the depth of thought that are put into Japanese cuisine. But there is a lot of depth that is put into the cuisine because food is really an art form in Japan. All I knew before is basically sushi and sashimi, maybe some tempura because my daughter is a foodie. But I live in Louisiana and we have certain types of cuisine and there are not a lot of good Japanese restaurants, so I'm not really that familiar with it. But I know now, since I've been to Japan, how fabulous it is in every way. It is an art form. So that's some basic information. Now, I want to share with you briefly the 10 top traditional dishes that you'll find everywhere in Japan. Sushi is the first, like I said, fish and rice. And it's been a dish since ancient times. I really didn't realize. For some reason, I thought it was a modern kind of shishi thing. It's modern to the Western world, or it kind of became real trendy, I think, about 20 years ago. But it has been around a long time. They've been eating fish and rice. I never knew that. And I'm a cultural freak. I love cultural trivia and everything, or just understanding what makes things the way they are. I didn't know that. Sashimi is even older than sushi. Now, that's the raw fish without the rice, and it's thinly sliced. So you would have a bowl of rice, the sashimi, and then the miso or maybe seaweed salad or whatever. The next is, I talked about the miso soup made with fish or kelp. And they also put that bean paste in it. So it's got kind of like a earth and a sea elements, even in the soup. Mm. And they add green onions, seafood, or pork, or whatever. But it's not just broth soup. There's more to it. It gives you health. It relaxes you. It's very healing. And it has at the basis of it those elements, the land and the sea. That's like spiritual to me. I think it's just really fantastic. The next is tempura. Now, tempura is battered and fried fish, seafood, or vegetables. And I had eaten tempura before because my daughter, if she sees it on the menu as an appetizer, what if, oh, we have to have some tempura. The main ingredients themselves are cut a certain way. They're just not chopped. They are cut a certain way. The batter has to be ice cold. And the frying oil has to be very hot. How they put it together with this technique is what makes it so wonderful. And I knew a little bit about something that when you fry it to make it really good, because in Louisiana, we love fried chicken. And they a lot of times use very cold batter, and then they put it in the very hot oil. But the Japanese take it to the next level for sure. Also, with this, you usually get a dipping sauce or flavored salt. And don't pour the dipping sauce over the tempura. Oh, that's definitely not good. Tempura is another one of the top 10 dishes. Then you have those pickles again, and they're actually called tsukimono pickles. They have eaten tsukimono pickles since prehistoric times. I never knew pickles were a prehistoric food, but in Japan, that's the case. I always associated pickles with Germany or Jewish cuisine. I was shocked that they are the fundamental part, really, of every meal. It just blew me away. And they don't use just cucumbers. They pickle all kinds of vegetables. You get used to it, and you really kind of enjoy the adventure of what this is going to taste like, and do you really like it? In addition to the different taste or the sour taste that they're putting into the meal to keep it in balance, mm-hmm. it gives a visual variety of color. So that's another way that they get those fives with the color. So you see, it's just amazing.
It's very thoughtful.
Oh, I don't know if there's any cuisine more thoughtful than the Japanese. I mean, maybe not quite as intricate. It's not just the seven food groups, you know, put it all on a plate. Okay, the next food type is yakitori. And I didn't know this was such a popular staple food, but this is bite-sized cuts of chicken that are grilled on a skewer. My daughter also likes yakitori, but in Japan, they put every part of the chicken on these skewers, lizard, gizzards, heart, whatever, and people love them. Because, well, number one, in Japan, they don't believe in wasting anything, because this would be unappreciative of nature's gifts. These are like shish kebabs without the mushrooms and the onions and everything, but it's a delicacy. It's a basic food, but it really tastes much better than you think it would. Grilled chicken sounds just kind of boring, but in Japan, it's not. It's not. Then you've got the two types of noodles, and both of these noodles are really good. The udon and the soba noodles. The udon noodles are these fat, dense, chewy noodles that are made from wheat flour. I don't see them in Louisiana very much. And they're not really prevalent. But in Japan, oh, lots of dishes with udon. And you can eat them either hot or cold. They can be in soup. They can be topped with a variety of vegetables or meats. But udon is delicious in Japan. Then the other noodle is the soba noodle. It's long, thin, and firm, and it's made from buckwheat. Very, very healthy. They also eat this type of noodle hot or chilled, and they have a dipping sauce. So don't pour the sauce on the noodles. No, if you have a little plate with a dipping sauce, you get your chopsticks, you pick up some noodles, even if they're hanging down, and you put it in the dipping sauce, and then you put it all artfully in your mouth. Okay, the next is sukiyaki. This is a one-pot dish of beef, vegetables, and tofu. It's cooked in a sweet soy sauce. Oh, delicious. And the whole thing is made in a shallow, like, cast iron pot. Wonderful. My last meal at my hotel in Tokyo, which Tokyo was the first city on my six-city, three-and-a-half-month trip that I went solo to Japan, I stayed at the Hotel New Otani. Fabulous hotel. I'm going to do a whole podcast on how fabulous this hotel is, because it's one of those hotels that's iconic, not only for Japan, but in the world. It's something else. But I wanted to have sukiyaki, and they had a very upscale, traditional sukiyaki restaurant in the Hotel New Otani. So I booked my reservations. It was a very expensive meal. I had to pay for it before. But it was the type of restaurant where you remove your shoes, the tatami mats, the low tables and chairs. The chef was a woman dressed in kimono. Every movement that she did was flowing and purposeful. The whole meal was really like a spiritual experience. But I experienced sukiyaki, and basically it uses the beef and vegetables and the tofu, but it uses the highest grade of beef available. And Japan is famous for its high-grade beef. It's Kobe beef and Wagyu beef. Somebody told me that one of the reasons why their beef is so good is because they feed their cows beer. So I don't know, but let me tell you, at this restaurant, I had to choose from 13 different types of beef cuts and grades. Mm. And I finally just asked the chef to pick one in the middle, not the most expensive or the cheapest. It was really a special evening. It was a great way to say goodbye to Tokyo. That's sukiyaki for you. The last of the top 10 is the kaseki. And the kaseki meal really originated out of, or it's an extension of, the Japanese tea ceremony. It's the food that was offered to offset the bitter green tea or the matcha tea. But it really is considered still the ultimate in traditional Japanese fine dining. It's a series of tasting courses served in the little small individual dishes. And each dish is prepared with precision and the utmost attention to all the details with the colors and everything. I mean, it is perfection. And what they try to do is they try to, here again, encompass all of those rules of five and all of those little dishes. It's a work of art. It is something else. And it's really considered haute cuisine. Even though it's traditional, they still believe that. And an interesting tidbit that I learned is the reason why they put this in all these little different dishes, in little mini bowls, etc., is because Japanese cuisine doesn't allow different flavored dishes to touch each other on a single plate. It's not like put the steak, potatoes, vegetables, And that's why they serve you only with these trays with all these little dishes that have different shapes and everything. I was blown away. And now you know, listeners, why they use so many small dishes, because they don't want all these flavors to blend in, etc. Also, it used to be so purist where they wouldn't even put anything on top of rice. It was soiling it. That's really why they still put the rice in a bowl. Yeah, it's for you to eat the meat and then you get rice and you mix it in your mouth. They don't want to do that together. That's attention to detail with thought and a reason. They want the palate too to experience it. Okay, now to the Japanese beverages. First is the green tea. This is the bitter matcha, super healthy tea that comes with every meal because it is the bitter element. But it is, like the rice, the staff of life. It is everywhere. And you really get used to it. If you don't like it at first, it just goes perfectly with Japanese food. The other liquid or beverage that goes perfect with Japanese food is beer. Beer tastes so good in Japan, coupled with the food, because the lagers are like, they're light, and it's also the bitter element, but it just goes perfectly. And now they have all these microbreweries popping up, and beer is a big deal. It hadn't overcome sake yet, but it tastes so much better, in my opinion, than sake, which leads me to the next, is sake, which is rice wine. And I have never been able to develop an acquired taste for sake. But it's not just made from rice. It has rice, water, koji, and some kind of special yeast. And this is really usually served with more formal meals. And a long time ago, it was the rice element, some of the meal, so they could only drink it at certain times and they couldn't have it while they were eating the rice. I mean, oh my gosh. But this rice wine and the rice, you have to keep it all just perfect. It's too much, in their opinion. Even though I really still don't like sake, even spending 3.5 weeks in Japan and trying to develop a taste, they're now over 1,500 different types of sakes, lots of varieties. And I must say, my only Michelin star meal in Kyoto, they served the sake there and it was good. It just fit perfectly with the meal. But I'm not into it. But it's part of traditional Japanese cuisine. Okay, a little bit more. To really fully appreciate, enjoy eating a meal in Japan, you really need to know a little bit about the table settings, the table etiquette, because that's all part of the experience. I hope my listeners don't find this to be too much information or too boring, but really, if you understand what's behind it, like in any culture, you'll be more in tune with the moment, the food will taste better, and you really appreciate it more. And the Japanese show appreciation for food and who cooks it. I'm going to talk a little bit about that too. The traditional table setting. Now, in the real traditional restaurants, you have to remove your shoes because they all have the tatami mats, and that will ruin those mats. They wouldn't last a month. They have the low tables with the low chairs. They used to didn't even have tables and chairs. Mm. You'd have to sit just on the tatami mat. And the food would be served on a leg tray. That's kind of one of the reasons why those leg trays were made. I always thought this was for some diva queen or whatever that wanted a breakfast in bed. But it really kind of started with this kind of eating.
Mm.
But now you can go to these places that serve the traditional food that have Western tables and chairs. You just have to make sure that your concierge lets you know before, because she might not.
Oh, I see.
And if you do, then the women are supposed to put their legs to one side together, and the men usually cross their legs. Just be prepared for that, and you'll have beautiful ikebana and the scrolls and probably the windows with the rice paper. It's a real special feeling in those real traditional restaurants that still are very old world Japanese. But the table itself, you'll have bowl of rice on the left, the miso soup on the right, and in between the individual plates. Now the chopsticks go top of the plate. They're usually on some kind of chopstick rest, and they're pointed left. When you sit down at a Japanese table and you get ready to order and start your meal, you should always greet the chef if they are around, or the servers. You actually greet them before and when you leave.
Mm.
And this is very common and very expected in these traditional restaurants. But before you start the meal, you say, itadakimasu, which means I humbly receive. And you're supposed to put your hands on your chest or in your lap when you say this. Now, for Westerners, they think, oh, this is a little bit too much. You can just say, oh, I'm excited about eating here. But they really like this because it's almost kind of like a gratitude, or it's a centering of the energy and your thoughts in connecting to the server or the chef. Think about doing that, especially when you go to these traditional restaurants. It'll change your whole mindset approaching the meal. As well as don't forget to compliment the way the meal looks.
Mm.
As well as it tastes. Then when you end the meal, now I don't know if I can say this word at all, you say, gachiso sama, which means it was a feast. And I learned this custom when I went on a food tour when I was in Tokyo, which we'll talk about later. But this greeting of the chef or the server before and after the meal, it's really very good etiquette. And do it. You probably feel good doing it. Bowl etiquette. Whether it's rice or soup, you basically hold the bowl in your left hand. You use the chopsticks in the right. Unless you're a lefty, it's vice versa. If you touch the bowl with your lips, it should be drinking the soup, and that should be with two hands. And if you have soy sauce, it's going to be in a bowl, and you dip your food in the soy sauce. You don't pour it over your food.
That's the one lesson we've all taken away so far. No pouring.
I mean, I'm serious. That's wrong. That's just completely wrong. Okay, chopsticks etiquette. Oh, those chopsticks. I mean, I would love to be sassy with chopsticks. I really do. I just think that's so cool. I watch those people eat, and they just in the flow, they put the bowl, and then they do this. And me, I'm like, oh, it's just horrible. I mean, I'm just so non-functional with them. It's pitiful. But you're not going to get a spoon in a fork or a knife in most of these places. Maybe at a hotel, they'll go get you at the Ritz or whatever. But it's very important because you're stuck with them. So when you're not using the chopsticks again, make sure you put them at the top of the plate on the chopstick rest, pointed left. And if you don't have the chopstick rest and say they're wood, just put them back in the envelope and put them at the top of the plate pointing left, okay? Do not stick chopsticks into any of this food, like vertically, especially rice, because, my God, that is like supposedly resemble incense sticks in sand, which is a funeral offering. Oh, and they will definitely be upset.
Oh, boy.
Very offensive. And, of course, don't use them to point or spear. I mean, you know, that's more like what you tell a child. But you never know. Somebody might say, well, isn't this good or something? Then when you hold the chopsticks, you hold them basically at the end, not in the middle or the front third. So those are really kind of the basics of chopsticks. And it's not a lot of rules, but I think they're still problematic. Okay, just a couple of miscellaneous table do's and don'ts. Don't ask for substitutes in meal offerings at restaurants. They will not do it, first of all, and they do consider it to be ungrateful because they've put a lot of thought about this. You shouldn't go to that restaurant if you can't find what you want on the menu. When you're through with your meal, move the dishes back in their original placement or try to figure out how they were when you finished eating. And make sure you put the lids back on the bowls and the chopsticks right, etc., because that's one of the signs you're finished. Then drinking with others. Basically, before you start drinking, you got to have that toast, and they call it kanpai. Most of it's when you just swig something down. But after the kanpai, then you can start drinking. And once everybody is drinking, it's not the right thing to do for you to pour more alcohol or wine or whatever in your glass. You should always wait for somebody else at the table to top your drink up. And they will, because it's part of Japanese table etiquette. So you are expected to also participate in topping others off.
So you can't top your own glass?
No.
Okay.
No, no, no. And then some people even consider holding the glass with two hands. That's really old. But the sake, maybe so. Definitely the green tea. But for alcohol, yes. Okay? So, everybody got all that? It was meant for it to be a joke. But it's pretty basic. But just to hear it once and kind of be familiar that there are little quirks and different things, it'll help you be sensitized to Japanese food and how I've shared with you some how it relates to their culture. When you go and eat in your dining experience, you'll kind of more get in the flow. That's kind of was my reason for going into all of those elements. So I know it's kind of a long answer, Catherine, but I guess I like to talk.
Everything seems to have a little bit of a ritual to it. I would say that that's a perception we have in the West of Japan, and you're really seeing it in the food.
Yes, which I really didn't expect that. I didn't know that existed. All I knew about Japan's food was Benihana's and sushi and sashimi and some tempura because of my daughter and the yakitori. But and now that I've gone, I have a totally different attitude, perception, love, everything. The food is fabulous. Really is.
Sounds so good. Our listeners love food tours, and we love food tours. And I know that you just mentioned you went on a food tour. So tell us a little bit about the food tour scene in Japan.
When I was in Japan, I originally planned to do two food tours, one in Tokyo and one in Osaka, because both of them are food paradises, or they're foodies. I mean, lots of
Heaven.
People,
yeah,
they just come to Japan to go to Osaka. Osaka has got this contemporary Japanese cooking scene and cuisine scene that is big time. But unfortunately, I only ended up doing one tour. But let me tell you a little bit about food tours in Japan. The Japanese tourism industry is still really underdeveloped. Most people who travel to Japan are on business. There's not a lot of day tours and this kind of thing, especially food tours. But it is growing because there is a lot more focus on tourism. So food tours, they are developing now food tours because they know how much people enjoy their food. So, but this is still very new to Japan. And I want to preface that because I've been on food tours all over the world, some better and some not as good. But they usually give a lot of history and, little tidbits or trivia and stuff like that, and how it relates to the culture and the food you eat, etc. I mean, the best one I ever went to was in Marrakesh. Oh, my God. That was fabulous. But Japan is slowly developing how to, in my opinion, really do food tour with a broad perspective. The one I went on, I liked, but I could have made a few suggestions. Okay, they really offer basically a drinking tours or what they call bar hopping tours. Then they have food tours that take you to the fish market. Now, this is in Tokyo. And tours that are just authentic food tours, more that are like traditional Japanese cuisine, home cooking, street food, that kind of thing. Okay? And then the last, they have the cooking classes. So I'm going to go into each one of those, tell you the one that I did, that I did enjoy, and how to do it, how much it costs, etc. Okay, the bar hopping tours. Now, these are very popular, but I'm not a drinker. So, and definitely I don't want all that sake. Whew. But Japan is a drinking culture. I didn't really realize that. But businessmen and locals stop by what's called an izakaya, which is a neighborhood gastropub, kind of like I guess you'd say in Ireland, after work all the time. So, and they have these areas where they go in where most of these izakayas are. Well, it's very popular to take tours into these areas because, first of all, foreigners, sometimes they can't even get in. And they're kind of hard to find because they're down smoky alleys and they have red lanterns. And you don't know if you should be going in there. You know what I'm saying? But it is a very popular thing. And these tours take you into these places. The big areas where they do it in Tokyo are Shinjuku, Shibuya, both upscale areas full of businessmen, and then Asakusa. So if you want to do this, then you go into places to drink beer, sake, mixed drinks. You're going to have a lot of little finger food and small plates and that kind of thing. But you'll get a real feel for the Japanese and how they wind down. Okay, the next one are the food tours that include the Tsukiji Fish Market. Now, this fish market is fabulous. It has been there for so long. It was moved. It was in a different location. But the fish market, it is where everybody comes that they can to get their fish, their meals. Of course, the chefs, restaurants, etc. But here you'll find not only the wet market, but restaurants, food vendors, and grocery stores. So there's a tour called the Tokyo Food Drink, and it's FOODRINK, one word, tour, at the Tsukiji Market. It's a really good day tour. If you want to spend the morning early at the market watching all this going on and then trying some of the different dishes, etc., this is a great tour to go on because you just stay at one place. You're not walking all over. Then you have the authentic food tour, which I went on, which is a walking tour, and it focused on traditional Japanese food. We went to local spots, home cooking, street food, and we learned something about the areas that we went in. This tour is called Walking Food Tour in Ginza, Shimbashi, and Yarakucho. It cost $110. One of the reasons why I picked this out, because I knew I was going to be in Ginza that day, and I wanted to have something to do at night. And this is a great tour for a nighttime activity, because you're going to be able to go to the izakayas, and you're not going to end up going back to your hotel room or maybe shopping or maybe even going to the theater or something. I mean, it gives you something to do. You're going to have to eat anyway. You're going to meet people. And it's interesting. And it was interesting. But this did give me information about the neighborhood, the popular restaurants there. And these are restaurants that the tourist would never really know about. It was 3 hours long, both eating and drinking. We went to, I think it was about 8 different places tasting food and dessert. Plus, we had beer, sake, green tea. So it was kind of like a kasaki meal, but we went to all these different places. And a couple of the izakayas, which was interesting. One of the most interesting things about it is it started in a little street restaurant that was under the elevated train tracks, and it had been there since after World War II. And they had started this restaurant there because everything was bombed out. The train tracks was the roof. Now, since they've created more interior space, but we actually sat outside for a while, and then we went inside. But you could really kind of get a feel for the locals and everything. That's where we learned about the greeting, what you say at the beginning and what you say at the end. I highly recommend that tour. Now, the thing about this tour, it's offered by Via Tour. And the other food tour with the fish market is offered by Via Tour, which is a very large tourist or tour company. And they offer tours all over the world doing all different things. But like I said, in Japan, the food tour, there are not a lot that are offered that you can feel comfortable with.
It's just getting started.
Yeah. So do the Via Tour is good. The only thing is you have to order your ticket on the internet. I didn't. I thought I could just get my concierge to do it. No, she had to help me work through it with Japanese. But I did it. I got my ticket, but I had to do it off the internet. So just know that beforehand. Okay, and then the cooking classes. Now, these are really popular. People come to Japan just for all of this, but they teach you sushi making, tempura, sukiyaki, home cooking, the bento box. Mm-hmm. That's really popular right now with all of these little cute characters. They make the food look, you know, happy. And this is really trendy now. I mean, it's not just a box of food that's very attractively done. This is like happy food, like your happy meal. But these are really kind of the basics, I think, about food tours in Tokyo. And it's really best if you go online, you do the research, you read the reviews, and you pick out the one that you think is the best that you would like to do. Otherwise, just let your concierge recommend it and let her book it for you. But this is my take on it. And I didn't get to go on the food tour in Osaka, so I can't talk about all of this contemporary Japanese cuisine that's just out of this world. But go on the internet and you can get a lot of information. And based on the reviews, I think you can make a decision.
That's exciting that it's kind of up and coming. That's always nice.
Oh, yeah. It's up and coming. And really, all the tours I found were pretty well constructed, but they weren't as, I guess, seasoned as I've been in other places. So it's just the whole influx of tourism now. And, I mean, there's not that many people that can speak English. So
to lead the tours.
Yeah. So it's an issue.
Astrid, we have a how-to tip for our listeners. We're going to get to that in a moment, but I want to let everybody know that this how-to tip is brought to you by Astrid Travel Club, and we'll be talking about that in just a moment. So Astrid, I'm wondering, for the how-to tip of this show, how do you find the best, your number one tip for finding the best food tour?
Okay. Well, knowing what food tour to take or not to take really is challenging. You will find a lot of food tours in the highly developed cities. I mean, New York City has hundreds of food tours. Major cities, Paris, London, etc., they have all different types. Like everybody else, when you're going to research these days, go to Google. That's what I always first of all do. Then you start making your list. You look at everything that's available or you start reading it. And what I always look for is tours that take you to the markets. Those tours are usually the most in-depth, thought-out types of tours because they really interrelate basic foods or ingredients that they put in. And they're always better tours, I have found, if you have a stop in the market. So I always look for that. Then I like ethnic foods. If I'm going to Marrakesh, I want to stay and eat everything that is ethnic from Morocco and maybe even specifically Marrakesh. I don't want too much fusion or whatever. I really want kind of the ethnic foods. And I want to go to the places where the locals go because those are the places are very hard to find for a traveler, especially a first-time traveler. I mean, you can read a lot of information, big foodies on there, blogs, etc., but it's still, if you have a local that is from the area that has put together the tours or cooks themselves, they know where to go. They know where to take you, and you get the real experience. I love those kind of tours. I just mentioned Marrakesh, and Marrakesh is one of the ones. I took a tour with Marrakesh Food Tours, and it was a couple. The lady was from Marrakesh, and her husband was an American citizen, and they were married, living in Marrakesh. Oh, and she's written several cookbooks, and she's really kind of become a phenomenon. TripAdvisor has it number one tour, but I took her tour, and it was just wonderful. I look for that kind of tour. But then also on the other side in Paris, there's lots of food tours. I wanted to go to the food tour that only took you to the Michelin star restaurants. So that was really exciting too. So I wouldn't say that's so ethnic Parisian, but it's very high class and involved, artful cuisine. And there was a mixture in there. There was fusion. There was some typical French dishes. I mean, we had the most wonderful French onion soup at this one Michelin star restaurant. It was, I think, the second stop on the Paris Michelin food tour. I don't know how many French onion soups I've eaten in my life, but it was definitely not out of a package. So you look for the ethnic restaurants or the types of food that you really want to experiment, because they have tours that are all dessert tours. Mm. Even in New York City, tours to go to Italian restaurants. I think there's even a pizza tour where you go to different places eating different kinds of pizzas. So there's a lot of different types of food tours, but that's the type that I look for. Now, you usually have a day tour and a night tour. The day tours almost always, if they're good tours, take you to the markets. The night tours, there might include the market and might not. In Venice, it included the market. But everybody was gone home and, you know, the market was empty. We went through it. But then in the evening in Marrakesh, the market was still just bustling. And we went to the olive market and the spice market and the wet market and the fruits. I mean, they were still there when we started the tour at around 6 o'clock in the evening. But typically the day tour has the market. And that's your preference. I like to take night tours because as a solo traveler, it gives me an organized thing to do at night. And I'm going to have to eat a meal, etc. And the night meals usually really end with some kind of big table where everybody is having a couple of glasses of wine or whatever. I have found that the night tours seem to be more convivial, not quite as rushed. But it just depends on your schedule, what you want to do, etc. And then, of course, read the reviews and the ratings, and you take from those what you think is ringing true to you. Then know that some of these food tours, you have to book them online. And I made a big mistake in Japan and almost missed mine because the tour that I wanted to go on was through ViaTour. And they have lots of food tours in cities all over and all kinds of tours. But you had to do it online. And I couldn't manage it for some reason in Japan. In the concierge, they were a little reluctant to do it. But we got it all situated. But know that if read the fine print or if you have to do it before you leave and get a number and a time, etc., make sure you do that. And the reason why I didn't do it, because I didn't really know what day I wanted to do it.
I see.
But some of them require that. And then when you get to your destination, cross-reference with the concierge. If you haven't already booked the food tour and you want them to recommend one or you're looking at one, get their opinion on that particular tour. And if they don't think it's as good as the one that they would recommend, ask them why. And I typically default to the concierge. They've never put me in the wrong direction. Those are the basic kind of common sense things that I do. But the biggest tip for doing food tours is do take one. Food tours are a great introduction to the culture of a place and how it relates to food. I've thoroughly enjoyed every food tour I've ever taken because it's amazing how you'll learn a tidbit about the culture or history that you won't learn in any other tours that you take or museums you go to or anything that you've read. They bring things out and interrelating it to food and then tasting the food. We started the Japan food tour under a bridge outside, sitting in little chairs with tables. And they said, this is a very local restaurant that lots of people love. And it popped up after World War II when Tokyo was just bombed out. And the locals, they did restaurants wherever they could, in people's homes, etc. And this one under this elevated, I think it was a railroad track, became very popular.
What I love about what you're saying is that it's so important to remember that food and culture, they go hand in hand. You can't escape one without the other. So when you're going on a food tour, you're really going on a mini culture tour.
Yes. And you learn all kinds of things, like I said, that you might miss on other types of tours. That's the biggest tip. Do take one. And then last, be hungry. I mean, starve yourself before you go on one. I don't care if it's a day tour or it's a night food tour. Invariably, halfway through, I am stuffed. Now, I'm not a big eater, but I've never been on a food tour that you're just not completely stuffed at the end. So those are my tips, Catherine.
This food tour tip has been brought to you by Astrid Travel Club. So Astrid is launching a travel club. We know that our Solo Travel Talk listeners are going to be very interested to find out about this. This is really designed for the Astrid travel experience. We know that people want to have Astrid's tips as well as maybe go on an actual adventure, but not be completely alone. So the Astrid Travel Club is for like-minded people who want to have these kinds of adventures. And you even have your first tour already lined up for this fall.
Yes. Basically, the Astrid Travel Club will offer affordable luxury trips for solo travelers, like Catherine said, that don't want to travel totally alone. Everything will be taken care of as far as your logistics and most all of your meals and everything that you're doing. We'll always have a lot of free time so you can go off and do the things you want to do or have some solo time by yourself and lots of fun. Plus, we will never have a single supplement and everybody will have their own hotel room. Or if they want to pair with somebody else, that's fine. But the bottom line is one price. There's no added charge if you're a solo. And I pride myself. I mean, I've traveled over 45 years solo off and on. And I love doing interesting things. So the itineraries of our trips will be special interest focused, like maybe garden tours. We're going to pretty sure do a trip next year to the Chelsea Flower Show in London. It'll be all about gardens in London and horticulture in England, as well as some sights and good food and probably some British etiquette or kind of like how to be British or whatever. I mean, you know, because they have their own kind of way of doing things in terms of manner and attitude. And I'll make it interesting. It won't be anything that will.
It's going to have the Astrid flair. I do not have any doubts about that.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to describe it. My tours will have flair.
Yeah, the Astrid. Not just flair, the Astrid flair. Well, and we're going to have a full episode that is dedicated to the Astrid Travel Club. Just know that this how-to has been brought to you by the Astrid Travel Club. You can find out more by going to astridtravel.com, click on tours, and you'll find the complete information. Thank you for the Astrid Travel Club for sponsoring this how-to. Okay, so we've covered tours. Now, I really want to get into some restaurants. You're always good at finding restaurants specifically. Do you have any specific restaurant recommendations or maybe even just a food destination, kind of like what you were saying about Osaka, to share?
Okay, no. Basically, I'm going to focus on Tokyo, Kyoto, and Osaka and make recommendations for those three cities. So get your paper and pen out, because I never had a bad meal in Japan. And in the 3.5 weeks I was in there, it was fabulous. And the food experience really was one of the top highlights of my trip. Every meal was like a food adventure. Even from a bowl of soup, you think, oh, and they have something else in it, and you go, this is out of this world. What I've tried to do in this list is give you a sample of every different type of food.
Oh, perfect.
If you go to these three cities, you can kind of have some options on this kind of food versus the other. Another thing is, you know, I never really planned where I wanted to eat. And in Tokyo and in Japan, when you're getting on the subways and you're having to go from one place to the other, unless you plan your activity in an area and the restaurant is in that area and you know how to get to it, or you think you do, the restaurant that I ended up eating with just kind of appeared.
Mm.
And the one time I had the reservation, which was at this Michelin star restaurant, I almost missed the reservation that I had to prepay the meal because I couldn't find the restaurant.
Right.
It was very difficult. But like in France, there are no bad restaurants in Japan because they go out of business. Mm. If they're not good, they do not last. And the Japanese like good food, whether it's real basic or whatever. So you don't have to worry. You don't have to say, oh, well, where are we going to eat tonight? We better get reservations and all this kind of stuff. It probably just stress you out because you'll have to go from here to there, blah, blah, blah. And one other thing. In Japan, a restaurant will usually focus on one kind of dish, like sukiyaki or barbecue or kaseki or sushi. They won't have a kaseki menu. It usually doesn't work like that, okay? Know that. If you do want to go to a very special restaurant, and there are many of them there, you have to have reservations. And you have to get your concierge to do it because you might be able to speak Japanese, but most of my listeners probably can't. So at these really good, popular, special restaurants, they need reservations. Some of them, you can't make reservations. So you prepare for long lines and see how long you can wait it out. But that leads me to a tip. If you see a long line in front of a restaurant, there is good food in there, like extra special. Okay, so here are my 8 recommendations for Tokyo. And I'll start by saying Tokyo has more Michelin star restaurants than any other city in the world.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. That's something. That'll just tell you. The first one, and here I go with this horrible pronunciation of these words. So
you get a pass.
Yeah. Oh, my God. The first one is Ninjiocho Imahan, and it is Wagyu. It focuses on that wonderful beef. It is highly, highly rated. Then you have Yakitori Imao, the chicken skewers that I told you about. They do have other foods, but their specialty is the yakitori. The third one is Maruka. This is the best udon noodle restaurant in all of Japan. Marukuka.
You got hooked by that udon.
Oh, yeah. Then you've got Temaware, which is the best soba noodles in Tokyo. And each batch of these noodles are made by hand. And this is one of those restaurants, no reservation. So expect minimum an hour in line. Mm-hmm. Then another suggestion is not a restaurant, but a food hall. Now, Japan has a lot of these food halls, and they are usually in the basement under department stores. The food here is really good and very affordable. So you would never think in a department store underneath in the basement is a food hall with great food that's affordable. Yep. So that is an option because you have all kinds of different cuisine you can choose from. Then you have Izitan in Shinjuku. That's an upscale area. It's an upscale restaurant. Highly recommended. Kikunoi in Akasaka. Great for the kazaki meal. Lots of people think that, you know, that's one of the best places to have kazaki in Tokyo. Now, that's saying a lot. In big Tokyo, whew. Then the last one is Sushi Sato or Sato. This chef, Takashi Sato, is super famous. He has 3 Michelin stars, a sushi restaurant with 3 Michelin stars. How much whatever can you put into sushi to get 3 Michelin stars? But there's only 9 seats at this restaurant. It takes months to get a reservation in here. But this is the place to go in Tokyo and to get sushi because he is so into what he's doing. Not only is it very informative and entertaining, he tries to be so in tune with the client and he recommends things and he's so wanting you to be overwhelmed by each bite. There are YouTubes about him. He really is like a cultural icon.
Isn't he the subject of the documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi? That was like the best picture, best documentary.
It probably is. Because he is like, definitely on a...
I'm going to put that on your watch list.
Yeah, it's fabulous. I didn't get to go there because, next time. Okay, now in Kyoto, I picked 5 restaurants that I want to recommend. The first one is not even a restaurant. It's the Nishiki Market. Now, this is a market that has over 100 restaurants, stands, etc. It's just a maze of little alleys and streets. It is a great place to sample all types of Japanese food. This is a very popular place to go. One of the top restaurants in there is called Nishiki Ware, and it's the best okonomiyaki in Kyoto, which is a traditional Japanese pancake that's topped with all kinds of different toppings. People go berserk over these. Mm. So that market, Nishiki, is a great market. So know where that is and go visit it at least once. And if you're in the mood of out-of-this-world pancake that's not just for breakfast, that is a place to go. Okay, then you have the Kajisen, which is a traditional Japanese tea house in Gion, in the Geisha district. And here you can have traditional Japanese tea. And what's so special about this place is it's wagashi, the traditional Japanese sweet that is served with the tea ceremony, is out of this world. Their mochi, which is rice cake filled with white or red bean paste. It is to die for, to tell you the truth. So that's one. If you want the real tea ceremony in Gion, where the geishas are, etc., this is pretty authentic. Okay, the next one is Yoshikura Tempura. Oh, rhymes. Okay, this is one of Tokyo's best tempura restaurants. And it's also in a traditional sukiya, zukuri style setting with all the different elements of Japanese eating interiors. It's basically old Tokyo. Then for tofu lovers, which I'm still kind of developing a taste for, but there is a restaurant called Sore Ion, and it is in the beautiful bamboo forest outside of Tokyo. This is one of the restaurants you have to take your shoes off, the tatami mats, the whole thing, but you have a beautiful view of the Oi River. But if you like tofu, this is supposed to be fabulous for tofu. Okay, now Osaka, 6 in Osaka, the foodie city. The first one, surprisingly, I'm going to recommend is actually part of a chain, but it's called Daki Suzan, and it's katen zuchi, or basically sushi on a conveyor belt. Now, this is so popular in Japan. Now, you wouldn't think that was cool. And the only time I've ever seen it was in Charles de Gaulle Airport in the international terminal. And I thought, this is kind of weird, but all these cool people were sitting down, so I did it. And it was good. It was really good. But what it is they have all these sushi chefs, and they're making sushi, all different kinds. They cost anywhere from $1 to $5. And your plates are color-coded. So you get to see and decide whether you want to eat it. And then if you're not sure, it'll come back around or whatever. Everybody is into this and you know exactly how much you're spending. I loved it. And I had two beers with mine and I was just like, it was delicious. I think it's a fabulous concept. It sounds like it would be cheap food, and not, but it really wasn't. It really wasn't. But they have other restaurants like this. But this is a chain with a specific called Keitan Zuchi type of sushi restaurant. Daki Suizan. That's what it's called. But they have them all over Japan. But they're very popular. I'm just really trying to make my, you know. Well,
I was just thinking, you're killing me with the show notes. I'm going to try and get all these links into the show notes. It's going to be so hard.
Another Okinomiyaki restaurant called Mizuno. And if you hadn't had one of those Japanese pancakes by the time you get to Osaka, you got to go here. Because this one is a Michelin star, 3-star restaurant. It's the best Okinomiyaki in Osaka. And expect a line from here because they don't take reservations. I mean, can you imagine a 3-star Michelin restaurant doesn't take? But in Osaka, there are people like, they're shopping and eating and walking and drinking and they're on the streets. I mean, Osaka's got a vibe. It really does. Another restaurant in Osaka is called Fujiya 1935. Mm. And this is a Michelin 2-star restaurant, and it is the innovative contemporary Japanese dishes and cuisine, the what I call the contemporary new Japanese fancy food. If you don't want all of that in a dinner, they have a great lunch that has small plates. One of them has 6 courses. It's highly touted. So if you want to go to a Michelin restaurant and you don't want to spend like a lot of money, because usually the restaurants are more expensive in the evening, which is like anywhere, but the lunch is not quite. So that's a good option to know. But it's got the real contemporary fusion kind of food, etc. there. Then another Michelin star restaurant called Iroha, Iroha, 1-star, and it specializes in kasaki. And it's in a royal hotel or one of the traditional Japanese restaurants, and it's all traditional, and it's supposed to be very, very high quality in terms of authentic experience there. They also have a market, the Kuroman Ichiba Market, and it's a food market. They call it Osaka's Kitchen. It's where all the chefs go to get their stuff. It's a wet market, a food hall. It's over 100 years old. It's just one of the things that makes Osaka, Osaka. So head on over to there. I mean, you're bound to find way too much that you want to eat there. But that is an option, and the food will probably be less expensive than in a restaurant. The last one is called Mon Cher. Their specialty are those famous roll cakes. I had never seen those, but these are cakes that are in a roll and the center is cut out and they put like a very light cream in it or some kind of whipped milk that they call it Hokkaido milk. And it obviously has probably some kind of clabbered-like consistency that's not sour. But, oh, they just love it. They have these stores all over. But Mon Cher is the best place to buy these famous roll cakes. And the best flavor is matcha. Oh, the matcha is absolutely, I've already said this once in the show, but I'll say it again, to die for. I mean, it's fabulous. The last restaurant suggestion I really will have is don't overlook the train stations. Most people, when they think of train stations, they think, oh, well, there might be one fine dining restaurant and the rest are just fast food. Oh, not in Japan. Their train station restaurants are really good. They're not the best, but they're not a bad alternative. You usually end up at the train station once a day or whatever. If you're hungry and you're ready to eat and you can't wait any longer, you will find something you want to eat there. I did it a couple of times, never had a bad meal. You hungry, Catherine?
Yeah, I've made a huge mistake not being full before this recording.
Well, all of this Japanese food information, some people, it might spur them to really plan a trip to Japan. I know foodies who really like food, they go. I mean, I was telling one gentleman from New Orleans, who New Orleans is a big food town, and he said one of his very dearest friends goes to Japan a couple of times a year just for the food. He loves Japan. This gentleman said he absolutely loves Japan, and he goes a couple of times a year, and especially to eat at the restaurants. The food really is just fabulous. On top of Tokyo having the most Michelin star restaurants in the world, Japan has the most Michelin star restaurants in the world. Overtook France. So I'm telling you, this is a place for good food. And really, like I said at the beginning, good food is the foundation of a good life in Japan. To eat is almost a spiritual experience for the Japanese. They eat slow. Well, they have to because of the chopsticks. But they really eat slow and they savor what they're eating. I found out eating slow, I didn't know this, but the slower you eat, the more healthy it is for you. You digest it better. It's not as fattening. Your brain and your stomach, it takes a while to get all the signals to get down there, and it's much better to eat slowly. And the French do this, and the Italians. It really is so important. The whole food experience. You'll never see anybody just gobbling down a meal in Japan. That just won't happen. Food choices and where you're going to eat when you're traveling solo around the world really are challenging. Sometimes I'm forever saying, God, I didn't really like what I just ate. Mm. Or why did I eat that? I should have eaten that. Maybe I should have gone to this other restaurant. It is hard. You're not going to have a problem in Japan because everything is good. I really hope that this podcast has enlightened the listener to food or the food experience that you'll have when you go to Japan, what to expect, and kind of prepare you for how wonderful it is.
Can I ask you a quick question before we close? I had a friend who went to Japan, and one of her comments was that even vending machines have high-quality food.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's amazing. And convenience stores and even certain restaurants. Japan is high-tech, so you order your food and pay for it at a vending machine. Then you sit down at the table, and the server will bring it to you when it's finished.
Yeah.
It's not like going over, you know, the menu and all. Yeah. So, yeah, the vending machines have great food. There's just not any real bad food. I mean, at least I didn't see any. And everything that I've told you, I feel like is absolutely spot on. So, Catherine, that's our show for today. The second in our series of Solo Travel Talks Japan series. If you've enjoyed the show, give us a thumbs up. And if you have any questions, feel free to speak your mind, ask away. We don't care. Comment in the section below because it really helps us with the quality of our content. And maybe we left something out or we missed something enough to create another show. And finally, we would appreciate it very much if you subscribe to Solo Travel Talk. When you subscribe to the podcast, what it does is it pushes out our program to a wider audience internationally, to people who enjoy this information or want solo travel information. I mean, I know Thailand is one of my biggest, listeners. So subscribe. We appreciate it. We value it. And it's like paying forward.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. And as they say in Japan, sayonara.
Listeners, I want to see your pictures of you being sassy with your chopsticks. I think that would be pretty fun.
I'd like to see a Westerner that really can do
okay.
it like they
we'll
do.
We'll see what we can do. All right. Whew. Yeah. This has been a very delicious episode of Solo Travel Talk. And like Astrid said, we do hope that you are enjoying this series on Japan. You can subscribe to Solo Travel Talk on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, any of the fine places that podcasts can be found. You can also go to astridtravel.com/podcast for all things Solo Travel Talk. I'm very hungry now. I'm off. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. We will see you next time on Solo Travel Talk.
Find Astrid on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. All things Astrid, including the Astrid Travel Club and this podcast, are available at astridtravel.com. Thank you for listening to Solo Travel Talk.